Chapter 24. His profession, a tolerable designer, and an admirable wit. M. Philippon designed many caricatures himself, married the sister of an eminent publisher of prints, M. Aubert, and the two, gathering about them a body of wits and artists like themselves, set up journals of their own. La Caricature, first published once a week, and the Chirivari afterwards, a daily paper, in which a design also appears daily. At first the caricatures inserted in the Chirivari were chiefly political, and a most curious contest speedily commenced between the state and M. Philippon's little army in the gallery Vero Dotted. Half a dozen poor artists on the one side, and His Majesty Louis Philippe, his august family, and the numberless placemen and supporters of the monarchy, on the other. It was something like Thersite skirting at Ajax, and piercing through the folds of the Clypeisop Templesis with the poisonous shafts of his scorn. Our French Thersites was not always an honest opponent, it must be confessed, and many an attack was made upon the gigantic enemy, which was cowardly, false, and malignant. But to see the monster writhing under the effects of the arrow, to see his uncouth fury in return, and the blind blows that he dealt at his diminutive opponent, not one of these told in a hundred. When they did tell, it may be imagined that they were fierce enough in all conscience, and served almost to annihilate the adversary. To speak more plainly, and to drop the metaphor of giant and dwarf, the king of the French suffered so much, his ministers were so mercilessly ridiculed, his family and his own remarkable figure drawn with such odious and grotesque resemblance, in fanciful attitudes, circumstances, and disguises, so ludicrously mean, and often so appropriate, that the king was obliged to descend into the lists, and battle his ridiculous enemy in form. Prosecutions, seizures, fines, regiments of furious legal officials, were first brought into play against poor M. Philippon, and his little dauntless troop of malicious artists. Some few were bribed out of his ranks, and if they did not, like Gilray in England, turn their weapons upon their old friends, at least laid down their arms, and would fight no more. The bribes, fines, indictments, and loud-tongued avocats du roi made no impression. Philippon repaired the defeat of a fine by some fresh and furious attack upon his great enemy. If his epigrams were more covert, they were no less bitter. If he was beaten a dozen times before a jury, he had 80 or 90 victories to show in the same field of battle, and every victory and every defeat brought him new sympathy. Everyone who was at Paris a few years since must recollect the famous oyer which was chalked upon all the walls of the city, and which bore so ludicrous a resemblance to Louis Philippe. The poyer became an object of prosecution, and M. Philippon appeared before a jury, to answer for the crime of inciting to contempt against the king's person, by giving such a ludicrous version of his face. Philippon, for defense, produced a sheet of paper, and drew a poyer, a real large burgundy pear. In the lower parts round and capacious, narrower near the stalk, and crowned with two or three careless leaves. There was no treason in that, he said to the jury. Could anyone object to such a harmless botanical representation? Then he drew a second pair, exactly like the former, except that one or two lines were scrawled in the midst of it, which bore somehow a ludicrous resemblance to the eyes, nose, and mouth of a celebrated personage. And, lastly, he drew the exact portrait of Louis Philippe. The well-known Taupet, the ample whiskers and jowl were there, neither extenuated nor set down in malice. And I help it, gentlemen of the jury, then, said he, if His Majesty's face is like a pear? Say yourselves, respectable citizens, is it, or is it not, like a pear? Such eloquence could not fail of its effect. The artist was acquitted, and La Poyer is immortal. At last came the famous September laws. The freedom of the press, which, from August, 1830 was to be a sore maison verite, was calmly strangled by the monarch who had gained his crown for his supposed championship of it. by his ministers, some of whom had been stout Republicans on paper but a few years before, and by the chamber, which, such as the blessed constitution of French elections, will generally vote, unvote, revote in any way the government wishes. With a wondrous union, and happy forgetfulness of principle, monarch, ministers, and deputies issued the restriction laws. The press was sent to prison. As for the poor dear caricature, it was fairly murdered. No more political satires appear now, and Rohi, correct the heart. No more poems ripen on the walls of the metropolis. Philippine's political occupation is gone. But there is always food for satire, and the French caricaturists, being no longer allowed to hold up to ridicule and reprobation the king and the deputies, have found no lack of subjects for the pencil in the ridicules and rascalities of common life. We have said that public decency is greater amongst the French than amongst us, which, to some of our readers, may appear paradoxical. But we shall not attempt to argue that, in private roguery, our neighbors are not our equals. The process of Gisquet, which has appeared lately in the papers, shows how deep the demoralization must be, and how a government, based itself on dishonesty, a tyranny, that is, under the title and fiction of a democracy, must practice and admit corruption in its own, and in its agents' dealings with the nation. Accordingly, of cheating contracts, of ministers dabbling with the funds, or extracting underhand profits for the granting of unjust privileges and monopolies, of grasping, envious police restrictions, which destroy the freedom, and, with it, the integrity of commerce, those who like to examine such details may find plenty in French history. The whole French finance system has been a swindle from the days of Louvois, Erlat, down to the present time. The government swindles the public, and the small traders swindle their customers, on the authority and example of the superior powers. Hence the art of roguery, under such high patronage, maintains in France a noble front of impudence, and a fine audacious openness, which it does not wear in our country. Among the various characters of roguery which the French satirists have amused themselves by depicting, there is one of which the greatness, using the word in the sense which Mr. Jonathan Wild gave to it, so far exceeds that of all others, embracing, as it does, all in turn, that it has come to be considered the type of roguery in general. And now, just as all the political squibs were made to come of old from the lips of Pasquin, all the reflections on the prevailing cant, knavery, quackery, humbug, are put into the mouth of Monsieur Robert Macaire. A play was written, some 20 years since, called the Huberge des Adrets, in which the characters of two robbers escaped from the galleys, were introduced Robert Macaire, the clever rogue above mentioned, and Bertrand, the stupid rogue, his friend, accomplice, butt, and scapegoat, on all occasions of danger. It is needless to describe the play, a witless performance enough, of which the joke was Macaire's exaggerated style of conversation, a farrago of all sorts of high-flown sentiments such as the French love to indulge in contrasted with his actions, which were philosophically unscrupulous, and his appearance, which was most picturesquely sordid. The play had been acted, we believe, and forgotten, when a very clever actor, M. Frederick Lemaitre, took upon himself the performance of the character of Robert Macaire, and looked, spoke, and acted it to such admirable perfection, that the whole town rung with applauses of the performance, and the caricaturists delighted to copy his singular figure and costume. M. Robert Macaire appears in a most picturesque green coat, with a variety of rents and patches, a pair of crimson pantaloons ornamented in the same way, enormous whiskers and ringlets, an enormous stock and shirt frill, as dirty and ragged as stock and shirt frill can be, the relic of a hat very gaily cocked over one eye, and a patch to take away somewhat from the brightness of the other. These are the principal pieces of his costume: a snuff box like a creaking warming pan, a handkerchief hanging together by a miracle, and a switch of about the thickness of a man's thigh, form the ornaments of this exquisite personage. He is a compound of Fielding's Luskin and Goldsmith's O-Tips. He has the dirt and dandyism of the one, with the ferocity of the other. Sometimes he is made to swindle, but where he can get a shilling more, M. Macaire will murder without scruple. He performs one and the other act, or any in the scale between them, with a similar bland imperturbability, and accompanies his actions with such philosophical remarks as may be expected from a person of his talents, his energies, his amiable life and character. Bertrand is the simple recipient of Macaire's jokes, and makes vicarious atonement for his crimes, acting, in fact, the part which Pantaloon performs in the pantomime, who is entirely under the fatal influence of Clown. He is quite as much a rogue as that gentleman, but he has not his genius and courage. So, in pantomimes, it may, doubtless, have been remarked by the reader, Clown always leaps first, Pantaloon following after, more clumsily and timidly than his bold and accomplished friend and guide. Whatever blows are destined for Clown fall, by some means of ill luck, upon the pate of Pantaloon. Whenever the Clown robs, the stolen articles are sure to be found in his companion's pocket, and thus exactly Robert Macaire and his companion Bertrand are made to go through the world, both swindlers, but the one more accomplished than the other. Both robbing all the world, and Robert robbing his friend, and, in the event of danger, leaving him faithfully in the lurch. There is, in the two characters, some grotesque good for the spectator, a kind of Eggers opera moral. Ever since Robert, with his dandified rags and airs, his cane and snuff box, and Bertrand with torn shirt out and all-absorbing pocket, have appeared on the stage, they have been popular with the Parisians. And with these two types of clever and stupid knavery, M. Philippin and his companion Daumier have created a world of pleasant satire upon all the prevailing abuses of the day. Almost the first figure that these audacious caricaturists dared to depict was a political one. In Macaire's red breeches and tattered coat appeared no less a personage than the king himself, the old poyer in a country of humbugs and swindlers, the facile princeps. Fit to govern, as he is deeper than all the rogues in his dominions. Bertrand was opposite to him, and having listened with delight and reverence to some tale of knavery truly royal, was exclaiming with a look and voice expressive of the most intense admiration, "A vous blagueur! Va!" The word blague is untranslatable. It means French humbug as distinct from all other. And only those who know the value of an epigram in France, an epigram so wonderfully just, a little word so curiously comprehensive, can fancy the kind of rage and rapture with which it was received. It was a blow that shook the whole dynasty. Thersites had there given such a wound to Ajax, as Hector in arms could scarcely have inflicted. A blow sufficient almost to create the madness to which the fabulous hero of Homer and Ovid fell a prey. Not long, however, was French caricature allowed to attack personages so illustrious. The September laws came, and henceforth no more epigrams were launched against politics. But the caricaturists were compelled to confine their satire to subjects and characters that had nothing to do with the state. The Duke of Orleans was no longer to figure in lithography as the fantastic Prince Rosalind. No longer were multitudes in chalk to shelter under the enormous shadow of M. Dargout's nose. Marshal Loban's squirt was hung up in peace, and M. Fear's pygmy figure and round spectacled face were no more to appear in print. *** Robert Macaire was driven out of the chambers and the palace. His remarks were a great deal too appropriate and too severe for the ears of the great men who congregated in those places. Asterisk almost all the principal public men had been most ludicrously caricatured in the Charivari. Those mentioned above were usually depicted with the distinctive attributes mentioned by us. The chambers and the palace were shut to him, but the rogue, driven out of his rogue's paradise, saw that the world was all before him where to choose, and found no lack of opportunities for exercising his wit. There was the bar, with its roguish practitioners, rascally attorneys, stupid juries, and forsworn judges. There was the bourse, with all its gambling, swindling, and hoaxing, its cheats and its dupes. The medical profession, and the quacks who ruled it, alternately. The stage, and the cant that was prevalent there. The fashion, and its thousand follies and extravagances. Robert Macaire had all these to exploit her. Of all the empire, through all the ranks, professions, the lies, crimes, and absurdities of men, he may make sport at will, of all except of a certain class. Like Bluebeard's wife, he may see everything, but is bidden to beware of the Blue Chamber. Robert is more wise than Bluebeard's wife, and knows that it would cost him his head to enter it. Robert, therefore, keeps aloof for the moment. Would there be any use in his martyrdom? Bluebeard cannot live forever. Perhaps, even now, those are on their way. One sees a suspicious cloud of dust or two that are to destroy him. In the meantime, Robert and his friend have been furnishing the designs that we have before us, and of which perhaps the reader will be edified by a brief description. We are not, to be sure, to judge of the French nation by M. Macaire, any more than we are to judge of our own national morals in the last century by such a book as the Eggers Opera. But upon the morals and the national manners, works of satire afford a world of light that one would in vain look for in regular books of history. Dr. Smollett would have blushed to devote any considerable portion of his pages to a discussion of the acts and character of Mr. Jonathan Wilde, such a figure being hardly admissible among the dignified personages who usually push all others out from the possession of the historical page. But a chapter of that gentleman's memoirs, as they are recorded in that exemplary recueil the Newgate Calendar, nay, a canto of the great comic epic involving many fables, and containing much exaggeration, but still having the seeds of truth, which the satirical poet of those days wrote in celebration of him, we mean Fielding's History of Jonathan Wilde the Great, though seem to us to give a more curious picture of the manners of those times than any recognized history of them. At the close of his History of George II, Smollett condescends to give a short chapter on literature and manners. He speaks of Glover's Aeneidas, Cibber's Careless Husband, the poems of Mason, Gray, the Two Whiteheads, the nervous style, extensive erudition, and superior sense of a cork, the delicate taste, the polished muse, and tender feeling of a Littleton. Ing, he says, shone unrivaled in Roman eloquence, the female sex distinguished themselves by their taste and ingenuity. Miss Carter rivaled the celebrated Dacier in learning and critical knowledge. Mrs. Lennox signalized herself by many successful efforts of genius both in poetry and prose, and Miss Reed excelled the celebrated Rosalba in portrait painting, both in miniature and at large, in oil as well as in crayons. The genius of servants was transferred into the novels of Fielding, who painted the characters, and ridiculed the follies of life with equal strength, humor, and propriety. The field of history and biography was cultivated by many writers of ability, among whom we distinguish the copious Guthrie, the circumstantial Ralph, the laborious Carte, the learned and elegant Robertson, and above all, the ingenious, penetrating, and comprehensive Hume, and C. and C. We will quote no more of the passage. Could a man in the best humor sit down to write a graver satire? Who cares for the tender muse of Littleton? Who knows the signal efforts of Mrs. Lennox's genius? Who has seen the admirable performances, in miniature and at large, in oil as well as in crayons, of Miss Reed? Laborious Carte, and circumstantial Ralph, and Copious Guthrie, where are they, their works, and their reputation? Mrs. Lennox's name is just as clean wiped out of the list of worthies as if S.E. had never been born. And Miss Reed, though she was once actual flesh and blood, rival in miniature, and at large of the celebrated Rosalba, she is as if S.E. had never been at all. Her little farthing rushlight of a soul and reputation having burnt out, and left neither wick nor tallow. Death, too, has overtaken Copious Guthrie and Circumstantial Ralph. Only a few know whereabouts is the grave where lies Laborious Cart. And yet, oh wondrous power of genius! Fielding's men and women are alive, though histories are not. The progenitors of Circumstantial Ralph sent forth, after much labor and pains of making, educating, feeding, clothing, a real man-child, a great palpable mass of flesh, bones, and blood, we say nothing about the spirit, which was to move through the world, ponderous, writing histories, and to die, having achieved the title of Circumstantial Ralph. And lo! Without any of the trouble that the parents of Ralph had undergone, alone perhaps in a watcher sponging house, fuddled most likely, in the blandest, easiest, and most good-humored way in the world, Henry Fielding makes a number of men and women on so many sheets of paper, not only more amusing than Ralph or Miss Reed, but more like flesh and blood, and more. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.